What's the toughest job in the world that often goes almost totally unrecognized? It might be caring for a spouse or partner with Alzheimer's disease or another form of dementia at home. Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese for Charity Nebbe. A new play opens tonight in Iowa City about the extreme pressures that caregivers face every day. It's called The Broken Cord. This hour, I'll talk to playwright Jennifer Fawcett, producing director Martin Andrews, University of Iowa professor Kitty Buchwalter, and Cedar Rapids resident Jan Petrick, who for years cared at home for her late husband Ken, who died from Alzheimer's in 2011. The Broken Cord, after the news. It's Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese, sitting in for Charity Nebbe. Playwright Jennifer Fawcett says there are literally thousands of Iowans right now who are caregivers for someone with Alzheimer's or some other form of dementia. So how many does that make nationwide? No one knows for sure. We're probably talking hundreds of thousands. And given how these neurological disorders get progressively worse, it might be one of the toughest jobs in the world. In the early stages of the disease, the partner, and it's often the wife or husband of the afflicted, may just have to help more with household chores and driving. But the job is bound to get more demanding, eventually involving providing very basic care, including bathing, changing adult diapers, lifting in and out of wheelchairs, and watching the person almost constantly so they don't hurt themselves. Because the caregiver and victim almost never leave the house, this hard work often goes unnoticed and is not given the credit it deserves. Well, there's a new play that's trying to shed some light on this. It's called The Broken Cord, and it's about the experiences of people who care for loved ones with memory loss. Written by Jennifer Fawcett of the Working Group Theater in Iowa City and co-sponsored by Hancher Auditorium, it opens tonight at the Englert Theater in downtown Iowa City and continues through Sunday. Jennifer, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Thank you.
Is this the first time a play has been written about the struggles of the caregivers, often a spouse or partner, who watch over the sufferers of Alzheimer's?
I'm not 100% sure. I think it might be. I know that there are other plays that are out there about Alzheimer's. And so I feel that a play about Alzheimer's is naturally going to involve the caregiver. But this might be the first time that we've focused so specifically in our research and in the writing and in the vision of the play on the caregiver. I'm hesitant to say 100% yes, because I'm sure there's somebody out there who could say, no, I have a play.
Well, I just can't imagine, but I guess you never know.
You never know. There's a lot of plays.
Yeah, sure. I had the chance to read the script. Of course, I haven't seen the play yet. It's not open, but the script is very poignant and very moving and involves, for the most part, just three main characters, and that is our two adult children of Helen, who is the person who's suffering from Alzheimer's, and the adult children are named Amy and Jacob. And so you pretty much stick with these three characters throughout the play.
Yes.
And we're just sort of watching the progression of Helen's disease. But there's a lot of flashbacks, and I want to start by asking you why the flashbacks. Helen was an archivist. Now, I'm sure you chose that career for the ironic, obvious reason that she was an archivist. And she says in a flashback scene when the kids were young, Helen speaking now, "The past teaches us about the future. I'm going to learn what happened so it doesn't happen again." So how ironic is this that her memory eventually disappears?
Well, it is definitely on purpose. Sometimes when I write with an image in mind, and there was an image, a picture that I saw of a pile of papers in the corner of a warehouse, and these papers were filled with important information, and they were molding and rotting, and all of the information that was in those papers was disappearing. And it was actually an article about an archivist, and I thought, how fascinating for somebody who has spent her whole life dedicated to preserving the past, to preserving memory and identity. I mean, documents can also speak a lot about identity, because they can talk about when you were born and when you got married and all of that sort of thing. For all of that to disappear for her would go against something that is deeply important for her. And so then for her own memories to start molding and mm-hmm. rotting. And I thought that was a really interesting metaphor to play with. You asked about the flashbacks. One of the things that's really challenging in something like this in theater is that we want to be able to kind of see two different perspectives. We're all sitting on the outside, and so we're seeing Amy and Jacob's perspective of their mother, which I think is going to be the more familiar perspective for most people, because we look at somebody who has dementia, has Alzheimer's, and we see them doing some kind of a strange gesture, or we might like the repetitive motion. We might hear them saying something strange, and to us it just seems like it doesn't make sense. But to have a moment to be able to see what they're seeing, to see the inside, to see their memory, and to see what they're living inside of, suddenly now that gesture, those words that may seem nonsensical, they do make sense. And so that gives us as an audience an opportunity to empathize with somebody in a way that we normally are not allowed. And so theater kind of gives me license to move through time back and forth. Also, a line that the character repeats a lot is, "I'm lost in time." Mm-hmm. And that was something that seemed to come up a lot in conversations and research about how time becomes so difficult to track. This idea of being in the present, being in the past, being in the future. I mean, we're all aware of our past. We're all thinking about the future. But we also know what the present is. I know that mm-hmm. this is the present right now. If I'm starting to have dementia, Alzheimer's, I might get confused with that, and present and past might join together, and which can be very disorienting. And so once again, trying to kind of find a way to put that on stage. And so that's why the flashbacks kind of allow an audience an opportunity to move in and out of the different perspectives.
Mm-hmm. One thing we learned about Helen as a mother, she didn't seem to be all that warm of a mother. She was really preoccupied with her career. And I don't know how this affected her children emotionally, the children who end up taking care of her, mm-hmm. but it did have an impact, and we learn about that aspect of her life. I know this is an unfair question, but is this case of Helen and her adult children based on some specific case that is in reality, or did somebody that you came across at some point?
Yes and no. No, I would say it's, I mean, Helen and her children are fictional characters, mm-hmm. but everything, all of the research and interviews and conversations that working group we did for the whole year, all of that was in my head when I was writing. So it would be a lie to say that I invented all of it. I'm pulling from a whole lot of different ideas and sources, moving them together, you know, mashing them together. It was writing about a topic like this. There's a real need, I feel, to be truthful, to honor the reality, to honor the truth of what has happened to so many people and is happening to so many people. I mean, you hear these stories and they're incredibly moving, and I want to do them justice, but there's no way to put them all on stage. And I read that when you've seen one case of Alzheimer's, well, you've seen one case of Alzheimer's, because Alzheimer's manifests so differently
yeah.
in different people. And so how do I put something on stage that is specific enough that we can follow a narrative storyline and really engage in these characters, but also still universal enough that everybody can see a little bit of themselves on there? And so sometimes making that fictional leap actually allows for more freedom. And so that's why there's a fictional family at the center, but then that's also why there are other voices in the play, and those voices are taken more directly from people who we interviewed in the research process.
Well, if the play is as moving as the script, and I'm sure it is, I've had two close experiences with Alzheimer's patients, one of my father, and my impression with him was he was living in the present later in as the disease progressed, and he just wasn't connecting with the past and certainly not with the future.
from my understanding is, yes, it can be really different with different people. And I mean, we even saw that in the interviews that we did and the research that we did. And honestly, I feel like after a whole year of having these conversations and interviews and everything, I still feel like just at the tip of the iceberg in terms of the depth of experience, the variety of experiences that are out there for people.
I want to go to Kitty Buckwalter next, professor of nursing and expert on aging at the University of Iowa. Kitty, is what we're saying hitting home with you as far as, you know, every case is different, living in the present, is that correct?
Yes, it rings true to me and my experiences both personally with my father, who died in 2002 of Lewy body dementia, which is one form of dementia, and professionally as a nurse who's provided care to people with dementia, both in the community and in institutional settings. There's a lot of variations on the theme. Some caregivers are enormously burdened. Others feel that this is a joy and a privilege. So people's response to the caregiving scenario can be very different. You mentioned something earlier about Helen's relationship to her children when they were growing up. And that brought to mind the issue of pre-morbid or pre-illness relationships, the closeness of the relationship, which can also affect how things are played out when one partner or person becomes essentially very dependent upon another. And so I think that issue is well described and portrayed. And to me, what I've seen of the play, it's very authentic.
Okay.
And I think people and almost everybody knows someone who's been affected
that
by
dementia.
That seems
to be dementia. The case. That really seems to be the case.
I think they'll relate to this story. And feel as I do that it does ring true.
And especially as one gets older, you run into more and more connections with dementia and Alzheimer's and friends, family, parents. Mm-hmm. Have you seen the script or read the script?
I've seen parts of it. I've seen actually a preview of aspects of the play that was hosted by the College of Public Health and Hancher and the College of Nursing. And so I base my comments largely on that experience. And having had a dialogue with members of the theater troupe about my experiences and then seeing many pieces of that dialogue represented in the play.
Well, we'll get back to our discussion in just a minute as we take a break. Talking about the new play, The Broken Cord, which opens tonight in Iowa City at the Englert Theater, a production of the Working Group Theater in Iowa City, co-sponsored by Hancher, about partners caring for partners with Alzheimer's disease. My guest, Jennifer Fawcett, the playwright, Martin Andrews, the producing director, and we'll get to him after the break. Kitty Buckwalter, University of Iowa, and Jan Petrick will have a very poignant story to tell about her husband as we continue after a break. Talk of Iowa, back in a minute. Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Dennis Reese, filling in today for Charity Nebbe, talking about a really fine play that we're all waiting to see as it opens in Iowa City, about caregivers, specifically caregivers who watch out for their spouse or their partner with Alzheimer's or dementia. The play is called The Broken Cord. The playwright is here today, Jennifer Fawcett. Martin Andrews is the producing director. Get that right, Martin?
That's correct.
You're also an actor in the play?
Yeah, I'm also an actor in the play.
Who do you play?
I play one of the characters who is in a lot of those flashbacks that you talked about, so that I come on with a dancer, and we move, and we do different transitions, and then I play a doctor in the play as well.
So you are the doctor?
Yes, I am the doctor.
Well, I'm going to quote. That must be fun to play a doctor.
Yeah, yeah. My mother's very proud.
Okay. I'm going to quote a couple of your lines, actually. This is the doctor speaking to Amy and Jacob about their mother, who's getting worse. And he says, at this point, there are definite signs of MCI, mild cognitive impairment. It's going to take a couple of days to get the results back from the lab on her blood work. But from what I'm seeing on the MRI, And from the history and tests she's just done, I would say that we're most likely looking at Alzheimer's. He goes on to say that Alzheimer's does not follow a set path. There are some things that seem to happen to everyone, but when they happen and to what degree can be different for every person. This is a really powerful scene as he's explaining this to, I guess, just Amy at this point, the daughter, and she's realizing what's happening with her mother.
You know, that's a scene, too, that developed as we were creating this play when we had – I actually sent, I think, Kitty an email, and I sent another person who was an advisor on the script an email and asked, what is the process for getting a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease? It doesn't happen at a family doctor. You go to a neurologist. There are very specific things that they put everyone through so that they can give a diagnosis. So it's an example of how this script, how we did the research for this script and how people like Kitty and others really helped us shape it.
Could I just say something? If you're lucky and have access to a memory disorders clinic or a neurologist, that's what's recommended. But, for example, people in rural Iowa oftentimes don't have access to complete geriatric assessment services.
And a lot of times they'll just – the doctor, unbeknownst to them probably, are spreading misinformation when they're just saying, oh, they're just getting older. Don't – you know, this happens, and that's not the case.
I'm forgetting to play the excerpts. We have two excerpts, and our Iowa Public Radio producer, Sarah Bowden, was at one of your rehearsals the other night and recorded a couple of excerpts. So let's play the one. This is an excerpt from The Broken Cord. It's where the siblings, Amy and Jacob, have one of the many disagreements about the right direction to go in caring for their mother, Helen.
You know Mom doesn't want to leave here.
What has she told you?
That you want her to sell the house and move into an old folks' home.
It's a retirement community. And it's in town, so it's closer to me. And they have activities and a big garden, and I just thought it would be nice for her.
Well, it's not nice for her if she doesn't want to be there.
She's going to make a cup of tea and burn the house down. This place is too much for her.
I think Mom needs someone here. Then she wouldn't have to move.
Yeah, well, I can't move in, so...
I can.
You?
I was thinking that I could move back here and help out. Take some of the pressure off you.
So, you would just drop everything in Denver?
There isn't that much to drop.
Yeah, but you've been living there for 10 years.
Closer to 20.
Okay, so you have friends. You have a life there.
It's not a big deal. I just wanted to come home.
Did you lose your job?
Yeah, but that's not why.
Look, you were hardly here since you turned 16, and now all of a sudden, 30 years later...
I came back because I wanted to come back.
She's changing. Taking care of Mom is a lot more than eating Jell-O and watching movies, and you can't do it drunk.
Okay, this was such a strange twist that I wasn't expecting. I don't want to give away what happens in the play. But the daughter, Amy, had been watching her mother for years. And all of a sudden, the brother shows up who had not been communicating with his mother, Helen, for forever. And he just sort of shows up and announces that he's going to take over. And watching this back and forth between the siblings is really, really fascinating. They work it out. And Martin... Jacob takes over, does a pretty good job.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things that in a lot of the interviews we found that the family dynamics and what happens between family members, because this is a gigantic stressor, and it's not an event that length of life from diagnosis is 8 to 20 years, so it's not a stressor that goes away quickly, and families have been torn apart by dealing with a loved one with Alzheimer's disease. And often it's the case where one person in the family will be the caregiver and everyone – and imagine the guilt around that for the siblings or the resentment for the person who is the caregiver and no one's helping them out. I mean, that's a story that we heard over and over and over again.
You did.
Yeah, very much so. And also Kitty told us there's something called the – if someone's in a retirement community or a memory unit, there's the – was it you, the daughter from California phenomenon, where someone comes in from the outside, doesn't deal with that person day to day, and then they immediately go, oh, it's – you're doing all this stuff wrong. And what this person has done is everything they could to get this person dressed and presentable, and the person who comes in there out of nowhere has no idea what it takes to care for this person.
Well, this is a case because they have two radically different styles of caring. And of course, this play is about the caregivers. And Amy was so – she wanted everything perfect. And I think the house was probably perfectly clean Everything was on a schedule, which was comforting to her mom. And then comes the unemployed son. Amy, by the way, is a professor. And he just doesn't have this sort of fastidiousness and doesn't care so much about keeping the house clean. And Amy is not really thrilled with this. But so we have two really different styles of caregiving, but they both sort of work.
Yeah, I think there's advantages for Jacob's style of caregiving as well, because so much of what we heard from caregivers that had successful, you know, interactions was that they said that they would accept where their loved one was at that moment, so that they didn't try to correct them and tell them that they're wrong. And they just said, oh, yeah, your brother, maybe who passed away years ago, he's going to come visit. You know, they accepted and they entered into the world with them instead of contradicting. And I think that's in the play. I think Amy has that. Mom, you've got to get this right. You got to remember. And Jacob is more, it's okay. Yeah, I'll play along.
But he also has a more difficult job because it's getting later in the disease.
Yes, absolutely.
And,
yeah.
He has, you know, has to bathe his mother.
Yeah, absolutely.
And get, tough job. I want to introduce Jan Pietrick now, the fourth guest here at this hour. And Jan lives in Cedar Rapids. And you have a story to tell that you sent me an email summary of about caring for your husband, Ken, who had Alzheimer's. You were married for 53 years, and he passed away in 2011 at the Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown at the age of 78. When did you first notice that Ken was showing some signs of the disease?
Well, I would say it started to be apparent to me in his late 60s. He also had several other things going against him. He'd had open heart surgery, had some memory loss, I think, from being on the heart-lung machine a little bit. He also was diagnosed with having PTSD from being a Korean War veteran. So we had those things going, but it was different. There was a look. And I just thought, he's just not tracking. And I kind of pushed. At that time, we were living in Minneapolis area, and he was diagnosed at the Iowa Veterans Clinics. They have an excellent geriatric department. It was very gradual, and I think other people saw it a lot later than I did.
How long did you care for him then, Jan?
Well, I had Ken at home until actually 3 months before he passed away. I was pretty determined that I was going to do it all the time. It was getting to be physically very demanding. He was totally incontinent for several years. He was starting to wander. He truly had no idea of time or space or where he was. He would often ask me, where do you think they keep the coffee? And where am I going to sleep at this house? And things like that. We did not have a good experience with a nursing home. And so I feel it's important, if you think that time may come that your loved one will need more than you can provide, that you look early on. There are not a lot of what I would call qualified places that people can afford.
How did this caregiving affect you? The play, The Broken Cord, we're talking about this hour on Talk of Iowa, mm-hmm. opening tonight, about caregivers, people caring for their spouse or partner with memory loss. I mean, as his condition got worse, did you get a break ever?
Well, I was lucky. I have a wonderful family. We have three adult daughters. I live in a wonderful neighborhood. They all accepted Ken for where he was and went along with it. And he ate outside with everybody, and whatever he wanted to talk about, they talked about with him. I'm so lucky because I've got a great support group. I also did get a lot of help through the Alzheimer's Association, through a support group I attended there and some special meetings. I got some respite care through the VA. At my church, I just think that you just have to let people know that, you know, when people are sick with a physical illness or if they break their leg or whatever, people come and call on you. But when it's a disease like Alzheimer's, I think people are almost afraid because they don't quite know what to say. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what you say. Just be there.
Did he want people around him?
Oh, my, yes. Yeah, he loved it. He loved it. It was, I guess we did well together because I just pretended the whole time. We, when he was would start to wander, I would have the twins on the TV for him and say, we'll lose our seats if we get up and leave now. And then I'd get him some more popcorn. We'd be right in our own home. And he honestly thought he was at a ball game.
Okay, the Minnesota Twins
Twins. You're a little Minnesota in my brogue there. We've just lived in the Cedar Rapids area for 7 years. So
what did he like to be read to? Or
yes, we read Dewey the Library Cat.
Spencer, Iowa.
Yes, and our neighbor, as Rob and Linda, gave Ken a cat that looked like Dewey, a stuffed cat. And that was the very last thing he had in his bed. That and his blanket of the Minnesota Twins when he died. He had we called it his Dewey kitty. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, he liked a doll, too. They sometimes gave him a doll. And to him, it was a baby. And because he loved children, we have 7 grandchildren. And he no longer could name them, didn't recognize their pictures. But the love was still there.
Tell us about taking him to the Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown. You say he lived another 3 months, but yeah, that was a good place for him.
You know, he was at St. Luke's Adult Psychiatric Ward after the bad experience at the nursing home, and he had no idea where he was. But as he got better, I had checked into the Iowa Veterans Home and decided Ken had been a Marine, once a Marine, always a Marine, and he was very proud. And they took him down there, and he came into the ward. He was in a locked Alzheimer's ward with 18 men of about his same age. There were 7 different types of dementia there. He walked up to the table and saluted, and all of those little men saluted back. And I thought, they were wonderful there. They were wonderful there.
Well, it's a wonderful place.
Oh, they were so – they treated every single person with such dignity.
When you sent me the email describing the years with Ken, I was so moved by the one comment. As his Alzheimer's progressed, you say, he always was asking me to marry him.
Yeah.
And you took that as a good sign, right?
I did. You know, I said to our daughters, these last 53 years must have not been too bad because he's willing to do it again. And he would even, when our pastor would come and bring communion, he'd say, could you marry us? And Pastor Dennis would say, I will do that next time. And so, yeah, he knew me. He knew me. He always, until almost, he didn't. Actually, it was pneumonia. You know, when you talk about dying from Alzheimer's, it was pneumonia that took him, which is often the case, I think. They have no reserve left to fight in. But he always knew me. He would, till he didn't speak anymore, and he would always say, I love you. So I knew he knew me.
Even at the end, he knew who you were?
Well, I think so. I crawled in bed with him and held him really tight, and I sang 3 choruses at the top of my lungs of the Marine Corps hymn. And I'm sure the entire soldiers' home heard it. But to me, that was what I could do for him to bring him comfort. I was honored that I kept healthy. And there was times that I was at my wit's end. I admit it. But it was my honor to care for him.
Jennifer Fawcett, the playwright of The Broken Cord, there's some references in the play to the importance of physical contact. With sufferers of dementia, that it's a good thing that to touch them. I don't know if everybody reacts that same way, but how did you learn about this?
I had the pleasure of interviewing a woman here in Iowa City who is an ordained chaplain and works at a geriatric clinic at the University of Iowa Hospital, and she was the one who talked about. She asked these really important questions about. What is the self, and when does that self disappear? We talk so much about the brain and memory and intelligence and all of that sort of thing, but on a more spiritual or soulful level. And she talked a great deal about touch, and she talked about going in and not just with Alzheimer's patients, but with people in comas and that sort of thing, and just touching them in the hospital and the body. Responding, you could see it in the machines that these people were connected to. And to me, that just seemed to get to something that's so essential to care, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, when you think about a mother and a newborn child, and how we really can care for each other, and touch goes beyond verbal. You know, it's beyond verbal. It's outside of memory. I don't necessarily even have to know who you are, but if you touch my hand really gently, I can respond to that. And I can respond to it in the moment, and it can bring me comfort. And so it's just – it's incredibly important, and I think – and it's also something that anybody can do.
Mm-hmm. Kitty Buchwalter, University of Iowa, is this what – have you found this to be the case in your working with patients?
Well, absolutely. When you said sense of self, I was thinking about one of the very first books that ever came out in this in the area of dementia care. It was called The Loss of Self by Donna Cohen and Carl Eisdorfer. You know, the person's essence, like you described, can remain there. And touch, by and large, can be a good thing, but you have to be very careful not walking up behind someone who's on a mission and surprising them out of their line of sight, because that can result in what might be determined to be an aggressive physical act when, in fact, it's not. So touch used appropriately can be very, very, very comforting.
We need to take another break. So stay with us. Listeners and my four people in the table here in the studio, and those four people are Jennifer Fawcett, Martin Andrews, Kitty Buchwalter, and Jan Petrick. We're talking about The Broken Cord, new play from the Working Group Theater in Iowa City, which opens tonight at the Englert Theater. Talk of Iowa continues. Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Dennis Reese, filling in today for Charity Nebbe. We're talking about caregivers today in a new play called The Broken Cord, co-production of the Working Group Theater in Iowa City. It's about caregivers who watch for their spouse or their partner with Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia. And a critically important topic given the prevalence of this horrible disease, and all the predictions are that we'll be seeing more Alzheimer's and more people afflicted with it. Kitty Buchwalter is one of my guests this hour. She's a professor of nursing, also involved in a lot of research for years in the area of aging. This is an epidemic, Kitty, in your estimation?
Yes.
Yeah.
It is. And the large numbers that are being talked about, the Alzheimer's Association in their most recent publications will tell you 5.2 to 5.4 million. But there are a couple things that contribute to that. First of all, we're much more aware of the dementias. People seek help for these associated behaviors and confusion and that sort of thing much earlier. And now you mentioned MCI or mild cognitive impairment. Now we know that there, before one reaches the actual diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease or dementia, that there can be, for years, earlier stages. Mm-hmm. And some exciting research going on trying to develop predictive profiles of who's going to convert from mild cognitive impairment to a full-blown dementia. So many, many factors have played into the prevalence. But as you mentioned, the changing demography and the growing number of older adults in this country.
Now, you heard Jan Petrick's story. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you've heard many, many stories that are very similar to what Jan experienced with her husband. Is this typical?
It's typical of the best possible process and outcome, I would say. Jen, you did a lot of things right.
Thank you.
You used music, for example, that was still meaningful. You used his historical affiliation with the Marine Corps. And so what that helped to do was evoke really pleasant memories. You were there with him, and what you did that a lot of people, caregivers, don't do is you allowed people to help you. You asked for respite. You asked for the neighbors to participate with you and to keep things as normative as possible. Too many people become isolated, thinking they should be able to do it all by themselves, or are embarrassed or stigmatized by the diagnosis, and they don't ask for the kind of support that you were lucky enough to be given. But you did it right, in my view.
And I also heard that you said that you stayed healthy, which, Kitty, that's a big thing for caregivers.
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
It can take its toll physically, emotionally.
Just not being able to get out of the house and having to watch your partner.
Forgetting to eat, forgetting to do those little things that is
not renewing their medications because it's so expensive to care for somebody else. So they become their issues become secondary, become subservient to the needs of the care recipient.
Well, let's also do our second excerpt recorded in the rehearsal for The Broken Cord. And here's an excerpt from the play where Amy, the adult daughter, has some words with her mother. Our mother, Helen, about giving up the car keys.
Are you tired, Mom? We can go home now.
I can walk.
I know. The doctor just said that you'd be tired.
My mind is tired. My legs are fine.
Mom.
Are you coming?
Can I have the keys? Just give me the keys, please.
Amy, you're overreacting.
The doctor said you shouldn't drive anymore.
The doctor has been having me spell words backwards and draw clocks for the last 4 hours. 4 hours when I could have been doing something useful, something for my mind, since that's what you're all worried about.
You have to stop driving.
Not now, I don't.
The doctor said
I drove
not
here.
Safe anymore.
Oh, for goodness sake. I've been driving for over 50 years. I take a couple stupid tests and suddenly I'm a menace on the road.
It's hardly all of a sudden.
I will decide when I stop driving.
I thought you gave the car to Jacob.
I did no such thing.
Well, he thinks you gave it to him.
Why would I do that? I need my car.
He got it repaired. Massive dent in the back fender.
There's nothing wrong with it.
Why do you have to make everything so difficult?
Oh, those idiotic tests. I have a PhD and they have me playing mind games. You have no idea what it's like to see this disease coming. Don't push me into that yet.
Well, she's still able to talk coherently in this scene, but things unfortunately get a lot worse, and then the son Jacob takes over, and he seems to be okay with the caregiving
for a while.
for a while,
yeah.
You have some other, I guess, townspeople in the play, Martin, who kind of appear, including a person by the name of Ellen, who is townsperson. Am I describing that right?
Yeah, I mean she's based on one of the many interviews that we did as a part of project. The project was really built from. There was multiple phases of it. One phase is going out and interviewing and talking and getting this material. Another phase is talking to people like Kitty and getting their advice and getting them to tell us what it's like. And then there's a phase that's where we start to improvise based on someone's story. So we'll bring actors in and we'll say, you have to take away Mom's keys. Go. And what happens is that they all have their own mothers and their own issues mm-hmm. with their mothers, and they draw upon that. And so at the end of this research phase, you have this massive amount of material with these moving stories and the personal connections of your actors involved. And then Jennifer takes that, and I don't know how she does it, but she looks at all of that and brings that inside of her imagination and then weaves this story out of it. So in a way, everyone is invested in this in a really strong way. Kitty is in this play. We did a public presentation at the College of Public Health, and I said to the audience, you are a part. When we present this, you become part of this play. And sure enough, someone in there came up to Jennifer afterwards. Jennifer sat down and interviewed her, and she became a part of this play. Mm-hmm. So it's really just been a wonderful process of collaboration and connection.
I totally forgot to mention the names of the actors in those two excerpts. Do you want to?
Yeah, that was Christy Hartsgrove and Saffron Henke. Saffron is playing the mother and Christy is playing Amy.
And before Jacob?
Jacob was Tim Budd and
Tim Budd.
Christy
sure.
Hartsgrove.
Anyway, Ellen, character says, I'm quoting, I'm reading from the script, the dance of the things mother can no longer do. It's a long list. These are the things she can no longer do. Buttons, floss, type, remember breakfast, write a check, dial a phone, tie her shoelaces, dress herself, park the car, eat salad with grace, operate the thermostat, bake bread, weed the garden. And the list goes on and on. And there's another similar list of as a disease progresses and when she really can't do much of anything, it becomes so really, really disturbing at that point. These are probably based on your interviews, Jennifer, that you conducted?
They are. I mean, no one actually gave me that list, but it's something that I inferred from conversations and that sort of thing. And also, Martin talked about sort of the organic process of how the play was created, and we were in the room with actors on their feet at a really early stage, really before the script existed. And we knew that we wanted to work physically as well as verbally. We knew we wanted to specifically work with a dancer and somebody who could bring that kind of language into the play. And so I thought, well, what would happen if I gave this list to some dancers and to see what would come out of that? And what has come out of it is really fascinating. And I find it incredibly moving, because when that list is being spoken on stage, the mother character is just sitting there, and it seems in some ways kind of like a list of failures, or I mean a list of things that she can't do. I mean, that's really hard to look at somebody and think of, and they're very common things. But then we also have the dancers moving around her, and we're using a lot of gesture work, a lot of repetitive gesture work, which is again something that we saw in our research and then took and kind of gave it a creative twist. And so I think I'm hoping that it allows an audience sort of like a lot of different ways to access the story and the ideas.
Jan Pietrich, does this list resonate with you? With Ken, your husband.
Oh my! Oh yeah.
Just some simple things initially.
You know, I can just tell you just a very small thing that every time we were both home for our entire life together, Ken would make the coffee first and bring coffee to the bed for me. As this progressed, he would go into the kitchen and be standing there, and then I'd say, "What is wrong? Where do they keep the coffee?" Then it was, the coffee pot's broken. It's not working today. And pretty soon, he didn't even think about coffee anymore. So you just see those things leaving that were treasured. It's a long, very difficult process.
Part of the process for you was maybe not as bad as other caregivers experienced, because he was such a wonderful husband and companion for such a very long time. It sounds like you had a wonderful marriage.
Well, I'll just share this. This was very sweet to me. Just a few, 4 months before he passed away, it was my birthday, and our daughter Kendra was here to visit. Took him to the store to buy me a birthday card. Well, he no longer could read, but they stood there for a long time as she read every single happy birthday to my wife card to him, and he chose one, which was quite appropriate. But he no longer could write his name even. So when she got home, she said, "Well, Daddy, what would you like me to say to Mother on this card?" And he said, "The first time I saw you, I was taken." And then she wrote that on there and signed his name. And then there's little things that he tried to write so that he could write on there. And that card will be with me forever.
And when was the first time he saw you, Jan?
Oh, my goodness. I was 20 years old. Okay. He was the Marine recruiter in Fort Dodge.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And that's how we met. He still had that same wonderful face when he died. He was one of those disgusting men that never aged. I always said I was glad I was younger, because otherwise people would think I was his mother.
Oh, and looking at the list, I was thinking of my father, who was late in the disease. He was, at one point, he decided he hated our cats. And I don't know why. He loved the cats for a while. And, and then all of a sudden, he didn't like the cats. But I didn't know what to do about that. One of your characters, Kitty Buckwalder.
Well, I just wanted to make a quick comment about the lists and the losses and that sort of thing. And they can be overwhelming, and they certainly characterize the disease. But one of the things that we train our students and when working with the caregivers is to not just look at the negative things, not just look at the losses, but to try and identify what abilities and strengths and pleasures still remain, and then to regroup and focus our interactions around those things, which change over time. So it's a real challenge. But try to find, for example, somebody who's retained a spatial ability may enjoy working jigsaw puzzles, but can't do a crossword puzzle, for example. So to focus activities and meaningful events around remaining strengths.
In fact, Jennifer Jacob and his mom play Scrabble a lot, although the word she comes up with are just total nonsense. But they were fun words.
They were fun to make up.
But that was something
that was coming out of the research was hearing a lot about word replacement.
Hmm, yes.
And sometimes people are incredibly poetic with their word replacement. So playing with that, the idea of kind of creating a language. And Scrabble is one of those things that holds on for a really long time and is very special to Jacob and his mother. And so that it's lost, the day that she can't play Scrabble anymore is a big loss for him.
One of your characters, community member Louise, says, "I kept thinking this is a stage that she'll pass out of, and then one day it hit me, my mother, the woman I knew as my mother, she isn't coming back."
One of the things that we heard a lot was, and Jan mentioned this, it's grief is really complicated with something like this because it's a long, slow process. How to grieve somebody who is physically in front of you and you're getting glimpses, but then those glimpses get farther and farther between. And this is, of course, I'm referring to somebody who's at a very advanced stage. That idea of how we grieve. And one of the people I interviewed, she said when her mother finally died, people were surprised that she wasn't grieving more. And she said, well, I grieved 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I've been caring for her for 10 years, but my mother, the woman I knew as my mother, she's been gone for a long time.
It eventually gets really tough for Jacob to care for his mother. At one point, he says, when she gets mad, she really gets mean. Now, she wasn't like that at first.
There, we found in our interviews, and I'm sure Kitty could attest to this too, that there can be massive personality changes in someone. It can happen either way. I mean, we've heard stories of someone who is very controlling and very strict in their life before the disease, who turns into like a puppy dog and so affectionate and so kind. And the opposite is true as well. And like we said before, it doesn't follow a set path. There's not something that you can predict that will happen to someone. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that rings true to the
Absolutely,
experience.
Yeah.
And the thing about being a caregiver, I guess I'll ask Kitty, there's no training for it. We're just about out of time, but I wanted to get that point in. Thousands of people caring for their partners?
Well, most people don't think about that as a role that they're going to or be willing to accept, especially adult children with the role reversal and everything. And most of us don't go to a continuing education class on how to be a caregiver. A lot of what we pick up might be in an Alzheimer's Association support group. There are training programs that are available that seem to help caregivers to understand some of the basics, the prognosis, the disease progression. But again, it's highly individualized. So I have colleagues right now who are developing caregiver support tools to be delivered on the internet so that people can go in and say, this is the problem I'm having today, and can find support or solution for that. So we're making progress in this, but it's absolutely not a role that most people conceptualize as being part and parcel of their life.
To wrap up, Jacob says at one point, it's like living with a child, but in reverse. She keeps being able to do less. I lie awake at night strategizing about how to make brushing her teeth easier. This is what I think about now. This is really a powerful play, Jennifer. I hope a lot of people get a chance to see it.
Thank you. I hope so, too.
Martin, just the basics on when
it's on? Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Tonight?
Yeah, tonight. Tonight at 7:30 at the Englert Theater. You can get tickets. A few tickets are left for Friday. You get those online at Hancher's box office or by calling 1-800-HANCHER. And then Saturday at 7:30 and then Sunday at 2 o'clock.
Play is The Broken Cord from the Working Group Theater. Thanks to all of you for being here. The playwright Jennifer Fawcett, thank you. Martin Andrews, the producing director. Martin, thank you. Kitty Buchwalder, professor emerita of nursing and a researcher into aging issues, gerontology at the University of Iowa, and Jan Petrick, who cared for her husband, Ken, for many years. It was really moving to hear the story of your caregiving, and I think you did a wonderful job.
Thanks.
Thanks to all of you. That's Talk of Iowa for today. Talk of Iowa Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had help today from Sarah Bowden, who recorded the audio excerpts. Thank you, Sarah. And Jim Davies, our chief engineer. And for Charity Nebbe, I'm Dennis Reese.